Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer reports on the new initiative in Louisville to have more public art. First, the September 14th windstorm thrashed more than power lines. It tossed debris across city parks and took down hundreds of trees. Now, with new clearings and sunny spots, the parks are more vulnerable than ever to invasive species. Kristen Espelon reports.
The visible impacts of the storm are not hard to miss here in Iroquois Park and in other parks across the county. Officials say it will likely take months to clean up. In park woodlands, the debris can also pose dangers.
Straight ahead, you can see that tree was snapped off. Tremendous hazard tree right there. Then it's very tenuously balanced on this trunk.
That's Bennett Knox. He's a natural resources manager for city parks. In Iroquois Park, winds snap giant 100-year-old trees in half and scattered branches across trails. But beyond the obvious danger from precarious branches, another less visible danger could be lurking in the soil. Where the wind knocked down trees, it created openings in the tree canopy. Knox says plants and trees that love sunlight, some welcome, some not so welcome, could sprout up in those openings before replanting can begin.
The longer-term issue from an ecology standpoint is what that opening means and what we need to do to help it establish in the way that we want it to establish, reestablish.
Knox says it could mean a fast-growing but native tree called the tulip poplar could move in, but it could also mean invasive species like the bush honeysuckle will take advantage of the new clearing. And if that happens, the parks could face yet another long battle. Parks Director Mike Heitz was with the department in 1974 when a tornado tore through town and practically balded Cherokee Park.
And with the winds that came through with the tornado, we think that's when all the invasives were blown into the area. And because of the sunlight, they were able to take root and grow. So now we're fighting with the invasives that are trying to choke out the plants that we planted in 1974 following the tornado.
Heitz says they replanted following original designer Frederick Law Olmsted's specifications.
Basically now, we're coming back to a point that the scar that was once there is pretty much gone, except for one thing, and that's the invasive species.
More than 30 years later, full-time park crews are still waging war against bush honeysuckle. Olmsted Parks Conservancy's project manager, Major Waltman, says part of the reason is that this plant is very hardy.
It is an absolute great competitor for sunlight, for nutrients, produces an abundant number of seeds.
Birds happen to love it and spread its seeds. And Waltman says that while bush honeysuckle seeds need sunlight to germinate, the full-grown plant can thrive in shade. Now it's doing just that in Cherokee Park, where the tree canopy has grown back. But the problem isn't just aesthetic. Bush honeysuckle may change the look of a landscape, but Waltman says it could also upset the unique bonds of biodiversity that have evolved in an ecosystem.
You have insects, you have mammals, reptiles, amphibians that evolve with plants in their local area. And when those plants are removed or no longer there because they're outcompeted by some plant that has not been there for very long,
it upsets their balance. And that's true of any invasive species that decides to settle in. For now, parks employees haven't even begun to assess all the damage, let alone think about replanting. They're still busy helping disentangle branches and power lines. Meanwhile, invasive species won't be waiting for permission to move in. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Public art is popping up around the country. There are more than 350 public art programs at the city, state, and national levels. Last Tuesday, Louisville announced it will establish a master plan of its own. Elizabeth Kramer has more.
Why is public art important?
Art is about life. It's about economic development. It's about who we are and what we are as a city.
That's Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson announcing that the city is spending $50,000 to develop a master plan for public art over the next year. While Louisville has had some public art projects, it's a relative newcomer to forming a plan for public art. Philadelphia has the oldest program, and Seattle has one of the nation's most famous. But what are the benefits? Proponents say helping the city distinguish itself and attracting people, including tourists and their dollars. That includes Barbara Goldstein. She edited Public Art by the Book.
Public art reinforces urban design. It can make a place extraordinary. It can help reinforce the public qualities of the space by stimulating people to be there, to stay there, to enjoy the space, to ask questions.
Still, some controversies have shaken people's faith in public art. in the 1980s, Tilted Ark, an imposing sculpture on a New York City plaza, generated a public hearing ushering its removal. In 2005, Louisville removed and severely damaged a large sculpture sitting outside the Jefferson County Courthouse. Then in 2006, Louisville sanctioned a graffiti wall for artists on East Market Street. Soon after obscenities were scrawled there, the city halted that project. It is exactly these kinds of situations that have led many cities to carefully create plans for public art. Goldstein says good plans should seek input from citizens, help delineate the rights of artists and property owners, and identify funding sources.
If you look at something more as a plan and a system of events and decision points, then you're more likely to have something that endures and can respond to change.
Other Kentucky cities have launched large-scale public art programs. Since 2002, the Owensboro Public Art Commission has put up 6 outdoor sculptures with money from private donors. In 2000, Lexington held an exhibition of horse sculptures called Horse Mania and auctioned them to raise more than $750,000. The money helped establish a public art program now run by Lex Arts, which is now beginning to surface on city streets. This is the sound of Lex Art's mural project. On the outside of a wall in Lexington's North Limestone neighborhood, an artist is putting up painted panels for one mural. He worked with the Neighborhood Association to create it, with its image of a beloved music teacher. Lex Art's president, Jim Clark, who also worked with the New York Public Art Fund, says a solid plan often involves anticipating potential conflicts and input from community groups.
Unless you have an organization that is structured to accommodate public art and to keep it going, you will be destined to do these episodic events.
In Louisville, Clark's ideas and those of Barbara Goldstein are definitely in play, says Meredith Johnson. She is a curator with an organization in New York called Creative Time, and the consultant who will lead the development of Louisville's master plan.
We really want to make a plan that's unique and dynamic and internationally renowned that is Louisville specific.
Among her many tasks, Johnson will hold focus groups with a range of people, including art historians and business owners, and identify funding sources. And most experts agree that the management of these tasks and communicating with the public will determine if Louisville's $50,000 is an investment well spent. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Good health doesn't come easily. It's even harder when you have no health insurance and can't afford nutritious food. 2 years ago, Louisville's health department started the Center for Health Equity to help level the playing field. They're finding measurable results are hard to come by. Stephanie Sanders reports.
Your life expectancy is significantly shorter if you live in the west end of Louisville than if you live in, say, Prospect. Cancer, heart disease, and other chronic illnesses are more prevalent in the poorest areas of the city. Health Department Director Adewale Troutman says tackling those health disparities is the goal of the center.
This is not a West End problem. This is a citywide problem. And we have to use our resources as wisely as we can to address that citywide.
It's a new frontier in public health, and Louisville's efforts in the cause were outlined earlier this year in a documentary called Unnatural Causes, which aired nationally on public television.
Cancer and heart disease are almost twice the rate in some areas as in others. But Louisville has many faces.
One of the stars of the film is the Center for Health Equity. The national exposure is one of the center's crowning achievements over the last 2 years, according to the center's director. With half a dozen employees, the center operates on an $800,000 annual budget, more than $600,000 of which comes from Louisville Metro Government. In the last 2 years, the center has held a lecture series, started a neighborhood store initiative, and promoted fitness and nutrition among kids. Center Director Lisa Toby says they're all small steps in pursuit of a much bigger goal.
If you're going to address the root causes of health equity, you can work on almost any topic and do that.
Toby actually keeps pieces of paper taped to a wall in her office to make sure all their projects are actually working together. And that imprecise strategy makes it hard to measure success.
We're working up to creating an evaluation for the Center for Health Equity, and it's new actually nationally to measure success for health equity. So for right now, we're sticking to some of the tried and true, which is using qualitative research to talk to community groups about what differences have occurred.
Without tangible results, these surveys will at least offer some feedback. Toby says they are starting to formulate a strategic plan and set firm goals on how to measure success, and they're looking for ideas. Sandra Witt works for the Alameda County Public Health Department in California. She directs planning, policy, and health equity there, and her team has drawn national attention for the way it sets goals and gauges success.
Ultimately, it's about life expectancy. It's really about, can we change the life expectancy patterns that we see in our county where you have these huge differences?
It took Alameda County 2 years to put together a strategic plan, mostly because when the main goal shifts from small things like nutrition programs to huge things like extending people's lives, you have to start thinking differently.
It really is a structural change and an institutional change of how all levels of government work together, and that is an absolutely longer-term process.
University of Kentucky College of Public Health researcher Dr. Linda Alexander says they're going about it the right way.
You cannot build a center and go out to the streets and say, okay, we have X number of dollars, and we want to fix something.
Alexander says $600,000 a year isn't a lot to spend on a project like this, even when no quantitative results can be seen for several years.
I don't want to give you the impression that I'm saying that you throw money after a problem, because if you invest in communities, very often, even small investments, you're invested in people.
This year, the World Health Organization issued a report called Closing the Gap in a Generation. It addresses worldwide health inequities and how public health advocates can turn the tide. Their best guess on the amount of time a measurable shift could take place is 30 years. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
You can explore our local features further at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Feature Stories. When we come back, I'll learn more about today's AIDS Walk in Louisville. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Gabe Bullard talks with scientist and author Jonah Lehrer. First, the 16th annual AIDS Walk and related events will be held today in downtown Louisville to raise money for thousands of people in the region struggling with HIV/AIDS. I spoke with event director Brad Hampton about the battle against HIV/AIDS in Louisville and southern Indiana and the increasingly difficult task of raising money for the cause. Let me ask you, first of all, Brad, AIDS and HIV kind of got knocked off the headlines after a while, but it's still a serious problem here and everywhere, isn't it?
It certainly is, and you're right. There was a period of time where HIV/AIDS was really in the spotlight, and there seems to be this growing complacency and misunderstanding that it's still a very serious illness that people are still dying from. We have had remarkable success with medical treatment and medications that have helped people that are living with HIV/AIDS live longer, some people. But that also means there's a growing need for the services that we provide, because there are more people living with HIV/AIDS in Louisville today than there ever before. Actually, last year we had a 52% increase from 2006 to 2007 of people in Jefferson County that were newly diagnosed with HIV.
Do you have a handle on exactly how many people in the region have been diagnosed or are living with it right now?
The last reported HIV/AIDS, Kentucky AIDS report, shows 2019 cases. In the Jefferson County area, cumulative AIDS cases that have been reported. And we realize that a lot of the reporting is delayed, and those are only AIDS cases. They're not HIV cases.
So you're still raising money to help these people, and I guess for prevention and education efforts?
We do not fund at this point prevention and education efforts because funding has fallen so much. When the funding went started to decline, and we've had a history of it declining since 2002, over the last 6 years, the funding that Louisville AIDS Walk has raised has plummeted. Actually, last year's walk, the 2007 walk, raised 45% less than it did in 2001. So with fewer resources available to allocate, we focus directly on direct client services that help people who are infected with HIV/AIDS and their children. There's no prevention funding available because we have to focus on feeding and housing and assisting people with medication, transportation to and from their medication, medical appointments, and counseling and other direct client support services.
Now, this walk is correct me if I'm wrong, the state's largest fundraiser for HIV/AIDS, correct?
You're right. It's the largest annual HIV/AIDS fundraising and awareness event in Kentucky, and this year is our 16th anniversary.
And this is going to be Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock?
Right. The opening ceremonies, live entertainment, a kids' zone, special guests, and food and beverages, will, along with team photos and on-site registration, will be available starting at 1 o'clock. That's when everything kicks off. And then at 3 p.m. sharp is when our special guests will cut the ribbon and kick off the 16th Annual AIDS Walk, 5K, and Pet Walk.
Now, how many people are you expecting for this?
Last year we had upwards of 4,000. We're hoping that we might be able, if the weather is good, to top 5,000 this year. We're fortunate to have Congressman John Yarmuth and Dr. Adewale Troutman, Director of the Louisville Metro Public Health and Wellness. Don G is our MC, and we've had some cancellations this past week, but we do have some special guests that are coming.
Now, we call this the AIDS Walk, but it's really a lot more than that. There's also a 5K run and some other events.
Right. It's we've been trying to diversify and expand our event to make it more enticing for more participants to come out. So there is a kids zone with a large inflatable for the kids and face painting, and then there is a 5K run that follows the same route. It is a $20 registration fee, and it's a timed run that's organized by Pacers and Racers Running and Walking Store in New Albany, and that $20 goes as well to help support direct services for people living with HIV/AIDS in Louisville and Southern Indiana. And then this year we've added a pet walk, which is an opportunity for people to bring their pets and have their photos taken. The top three fundraisers in the pet walk will receive a pet-related prize, and so we invite people to bring their pets this year.
Now, the AIDS Walk itself, this goes across the Ohio River on the Clark Memorial Bridge?
Right. Our slogan is A Bridge of Hope since 1993, so it's fitting that we cross the Clark Memorial 2nd Street Bridge. And since we serve people on both sides of the river in Louisville and Southern Indiana, it's great that we're able to walk across the bridge to Jeffersonville and then return back to the Belvedere, because it helps connect the two communities that we're serving.
Is there a specific entry fee or cost for the walk?
There's no entrance or registration fee for the walk or the pet walk. We just ask that you collect donations from your families and friends, coworkers, and members of your school or faith community. And they can do that easily by registering online at LouisvilleAIDSWalk.org, or we can also do a online donation on that website. Or there will be also be on-site registration the day of the event. But there's no cost to register for the walk or the run. There's just a $20 fee to participate in the timed 5K run.
That was Brad Hampton, event director of the 16th Annual AIDS Walk, which begins at 3 o'clock this afternoon on the Belvedere in downtown Louisville. Scientist and author Jonah Lehrer is probably best known for his book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Lehrer has shared his theories on art and science in many magazines, newspapers, and even NPR's Radio Lab. This week, he spoke at the annual Idea Festival in Louisville. Gabe Bullard talked with Lehrer at the festival.
I overheard a couple people talking about the book, and they said, Proust was a neuroscientist. What? So, so he could explain that?
It's a strange idea, I know. We might draw very clear lines between facts and science and experiments and fictions and novels and paintings and art. You know, I tried to collapse that distinction, and I argue that Proust literally was a neuroscientist, that he discovered in his novels real, tangible truths about how the mind works. And in Proust's case, about how our memory works, that neuroscience would only later rediscover, in a sense.
How do you think he came to some of those conclusions?
I think his big method was introspection. He was a strange fellow who spent a lot of time lying in bed thinking about his childhood memories. And I think it was paying such exquisite attention to his mind that allowed him to really anticipate these kind of surprising scientific ideas about how his mind worked and how our memory works. So it was simply by lying in bed and thinking about his memory that really allowed him to, I think, come up with these real insights and epiphanies and, you know, to how his own memory and how everyone's memory works.
Kind of like the thought experiments that you hear some physicists talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously Proust wasn't doing experiments. He wasn't sitting in his Parisian apartment kind of twiddling with test tubes. He was lying there and thinking. And I think that's a, you know, real process that is so often neglected now. We kind of look down on introspection as not rigorous or lazy, and yet that's another way to understand how our mind works. We don't simply have to break the brain apart into lists of chemicals and acronyms and cells doing electrical things. We can also understand who we are and how this here works by simply thinking about how it works, by reflecting on ourselves.
So do you think scientists should be looking towards artists to find something new to study or to kind of expand their field of study?
Absolutely. You know, obviously, Proust isn't going to invent Prozac or some other drug, and reading George Eliot or Walt Whitman or Virginia Woolf or some of the other artists I talk about in the book, they're not going to help you win the Nobel Prize. They're not going to help you do your daily science experiment. But I think one thing they can do is help you ask better questions. The brain is so complex, and we're so often trapped into simplified models of how the brain works, that by paying attention to these artists who have these very rich, complex, and realistic-seeming models, that is why we still read Proust or why we still read Shakespeare, because they created art that feels true to us, and that's why it endures. I think you can learn to ask better questions. You can learn to ask better questions and do better experiments.
Is that underpinning of science what kind of makes a work last?
You know, it's certainly not the only thing, but I think it's part of what plays a role into, you know, why we still look at the same, you know, these old paintings or still read these old novels, because they've captured something essential about human nature and human reality. And that, I think, is why they still seem so relevant. That's why we still read Hamlet, because that describes something really interesting, and it still feels relevant even after 500 years. Or why we still look at Jackson Pollock paintings. And I think you can learn interesting things about the brain by reverse engineering the art, so to speak, by trying to figure out why drips of paint on a canvas or some cubist painting, why that's so captivating to the eye and the visual cortex. That allows you to learn something about the visual cortex.
What about some of the artists who are pretty successful or deemed critically relevant or culturally relevant today in something like music or filmmaking or television?
Sure. One of the artists I'll be talking about in my lecture at the Idea Festival is Kanye West. He's a modern hip-hop star. And you can look at his, in the same way you could look at a Beethoven symphony, you can analyze his 3-minute pop song and learn something interesting about how the brain works. You know, what bag of tricks he uses in his art to kind of captivate your auditory cortex and these cells in your brain. So this isn't simply about great canonical works. You can do this for Kanye West. You can go to, McDonald's and learn something interesting about your tongue. Simply by looking at the world in this very open-ended manner, I think you can investigate all sorts of things and come up with all sorts of interesting questions and hopefully interesting answers.
What other kind of, or specifically, what could be some of the tricks used by Kanye West in making, is it making the song catchier? Is it making the song just more appealing in general?
It's got to do with the catchiness, or at least that's my take on it. I talk about him in terms of patterns and how the brain's a pattern-making machine, how we're always searching for patterns, and one thing Kanye West kind of plays with is he gives your brain a pattern, those two or three second samples that he's so famous for, that he'll steal from some other old Marvin Gaye song or Laura Nyro song or whatever. And he does something very interesting. He'll play this pattern many times, so it'll repeat for like 12 times, then he'll stop it abruptly. And so your brain's like, what happened to my pattern? I thought that was going to keep on going. And then it comes back. Except this time he repeats it for like 10 times or 9 times or 8 times. Then it stops again and then comes back and repeats for 6 times or 15 times. But the point is you never know when the pattern's going to stop and start. And it's that uncertainty, I argue, that's so riveting, that is so captivating, that gives the song its momentum. The fact that you never know when the sample's going to come in and leave and come in and leave. He injects this inherent unpredictability into his music, and that's what makes his music so, I think, riveting to the audience.
Is that something that you found in music going back the past 100, 200, 300 years?
Absolutely. Beethoven uses the same tricks in his symphonies. You know, Bob Dylan uses the same tricks. That is an essential feature of music. This is neuroscientists will talk about music in terms of patterns, not melodies per se, but in terms of patterns. And I think all great music kind of hijacks that machinery, that same machinery. And that, I think, is one of the interesting things about combining art and science and looking at art through the prism of science, is you find all sorts of weird connections. You see that Kanye West uses the same tricks as Beethoven or Wagner or whoever. You see all these commonalities that at first glance seem totally ridiculous.
So do you think that it's more of a coincidence that all these same tricks have been used, or is that something when you, I guess, see that someone is they say, oh, they're a talented producer, a talented songwriter, a composer, that it's something they've tapped into.
Obviously Kanye West isn't sitting there going, I wonder what my neurons are doing right now. Or maybe he is, in which case I apologize, Kanye. But I think a lot of this is intuitive. I think they're sitting there listening to music, trying to figure out how to make their music better. They're like a painter, kind of putting a brushstroke there and then stepping back and looking at it and saying, well, there or there? And they experiment. It's kind of an experimental process in its own way. And that's what allows them, I think, to come up with these insights. Is there always interrogating their work? They're always trying to figure out how to make this song or this painting or this novel better and more captivating. And it's that search for beauty that I think inevitably gets tangled up with the truth a little bit.
So it's not so much an inborn ability to see something that's more appealing as it is a desire to find something more appealing.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I think being rigorous and always kind of asking questions of your work. You know, I talk about a 19th century chef in my book as well. And his advice to young chefs was taste. Taste and taste again. Always ask your tongue what it thinks of the sauce or the dish. And that's how you'll figure out how your tongue works.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Gabe Buller talking to scientist Jonah Lehrer. You can see a video of that interview at WFPL.org. When we come back, Stephanie Sanders talks with the executive director of the National Safe Place Program about its 25th anniversary. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher interviews the author of American Wife, which is loosely based on the current First Lady. First, National Safe Place is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. The Louisville-based organization is holding its national conference later this week. Stephanie Sanders spoke with Executive Director Sandy Bowen about the organization, how it's grown, and where it's going.
To start us off, Sandy, could you just tell me a little bit about what National Safe Place is, what the mission is there?
The mission of a National Safe Place is to create safety networks across the country where young people who are experiencing a problem or need immediate help and safety can access help quickly and safely and be connected to agencies in their community where they can get the counseling and support that they need.
Okay, and then can you go over a little bit the history of how the organization has grown?
Sure. Safe Place started here in Louisville, Kentucky, in 1983 as a response to a community need for young people to have access to help in their own neighborhoods. And as a result of fire stations and fast food restaurants and other such businesses and community organizations got involved and made their locations available as places where these young people could come if they were being abused, if they were being neglected, if they were kicked out of their home, if they just needed some help at a particular time in their life. And the program worked so well in Louisville that there were federal administrators that were interested in helping to expand the project nationally. And so we launched the program throughout the southeastern portion of the country within the first couple of years. And now Safe Place is available in 900 communities in 40 states across the country. It's operated by about 140 youth-serving agencies that operate a Safe Place program.
And is it continuing to grow?
It is continuing to grow. We have our national conference here, October the 2nd through the 4th, and we have a number of agencies that are coming to Louisville to the conference to explore the possibility of getting their agency connected and utilizing Safe Place as an outreach program for their agency.
Is that the primary purpose of the conference, is to get people who maybe don't have it in their communities to come and see what it's about? Or is part of it also sort of professional development, if you will, for people who already have it in their communities?
Yes, it's a little bit of both. This is the one time when Safe Place coordinators from across the country can get together, network, learn best practices from what is other agencies are doing, and it is definitely a time of professional development for our existing programs, as well as an opportunity for new communities to come and get a sense of what it takes to operate a Safe Place program. We have a training component for new agencies that have made a decision to implement this program as a part of the conference as well.
What are some of the things a community needs to start a Safe Place program?
The first thing a community needs in order to start Safe Place is the availability of an agency that can provide counseling, that can provide residential services in the event that a young person can't be sent home, and the ability to form collaborations within their area with schools, with law enforcement, with fire departments, with transit systems, as well as the businesses, because the program works as a public-private partnership, and it's built on the premise of having successful collaborations within the community, with everybody working to make sure that these kids are safe.
That was National Safe Place Executive Director Sandy Bowen speaking with WFPL's Stephanie Sanders. It's always a challenge for an author to write a book based on a real person, but when that real person is the current First Lady, the challenge is tenfold. Author Curtis Suttenfeld rose to the occasion in her latest novel, American Wife, is loosely based on the life of Laura Bush. Robin Fisher spoke with Suttenfeld about writing the fictional life of a public figure.
So let's just dive right into it. This book is based on the life of Laura Bush. Why?
Well, basically, I am a Democrat, but I've always been intrigued by Laura Bush, and I've always liked her. And I think that she's a discreet person, but then just in general, someone who's in the spotlight like that has to, you know, be protective of her own privacy. And there's so much that we'll, I think, probably never know about her. And so I don't think the book, I mean, it doesn't pretend to really tell you Laura Bush's secrets, but instead, using fiction, it imagines what the life must be like for someone who becomes First Lady, you know, who's led a life which does have parallels to Laura Bush's.
Well, you know, that's interesting, what you just said, because I wondered, when you were writing the book, did the characters take on a life of their own, or did you always have the image of the Bushes in your head? Because so much of the book, the majority of it, has to be fiction.
That's exactly right. And I would say that definitely the characters do have a life of their own. The way I did it is that the book has four long sections, and each section has sort of a big event that has a real-life parallel in Laura Bush's life. Like, for instance, in real life, she and George Bush met when they were about 30 at a backyard barbecue, and they got engaged within 6 weeks of meeting and married within 6 weeks of getting engaged. And so that does indeed happen to the couple in American Wife. But, of course, you know, I wasn't at that backyard barbecue where they met. And so those scenes are made up, but even there's all these sort of subplots and other characters and things that happen and settings and dialogue, and all of that has to be made up because basically it's written in such a detailed way that the information really doesn't exist, even if I wanted to steal it from real life.
Right, you'd have to sit down with her and say, okay, then what came next?
Yeah, and I think that would not have happened.
Well, you know, I would get all wrapped up with the characters and sort of forget you know, who they were based on. But then each time I came back to the book, it was sort of with me. And until I got really back into my rhythm of reading, it felt so voyeuristic.
Yeah, I've had people say that to me. And, you know, in all honesty, people have said that particularly about the sort of romantic scenes or the sex scenes where people say, like, I felt like I shouldn't be looking. But I can assure you those scenes are fictitious. And, I mean, part of the reason I put some of the very intimate stuff in is that in a lot of ways the book is about a marriage, a 30-year marriage. And because this couple gets married so quickly, you think, well, they must be very attracted to each other. They must, you know, feel very comfortable around each other. And I felt like that had to be shown on the page to be convincing.
Well, you know, actually, I want to skip ahead a little bit because I had this as a later question. But I do think that the book is appropriately titled. You know, you said it's a picture of a marriage. And I do think that it is a pretty accurate portrait of an American wife of a certain time.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's actually a generation older than I myself am. You know, I'm now 33. The main character, Alice, when the book ends, she's 61. But I do think that so much of it is, you know, there's these elements that are about fame and privilege and politics, but it's really about the dynamic of living with another person for such a long time and knowing a person so well. Sometimes it feels like too well. And then, you know, everyone always says when you get married, you don't just marry a person, you marry a family. And so about Alice interacting with her in-laws and especially with her sort of imperious mother-in-law. And so I think a lot of elements of her story are universal.
How did you do your research for this book?
Well, I read a bunch of books about the White House or about political campaigns, and then I also did, you know, plenty of non-White House-related research. For example, everything that in real life happened to the Bushes in Texas, I've moved to Wisconsin. And so I've never lived in Wisconsin, although I have a really good friend who does. So I ordered 1960s Wisconsin yearbooks off eBay, and I would kind of pore over them and read them. And then I had a bunch of women from Wisconsin who are about 60 read the book to check it for sort of factual accuracy. And I ended up, you know, if I had specific questions about baseball or about Princeton University, which figures in the novel, I would seek out people who knew things on those subjects, or about Lutheranism is sort of, I mean, it's not prominent, but I always did want to get the details right as much as I could.
You know, the book starts in the early 60s, and I think as the book unfolds, you see the country change.
Which I think happened. You know, I hope that the book captures the way that things unfolded, you know, and especially the sort of shifts in what's considered proper, decorous, I think expanded greatly over those decades.
I would agree with that, with the vision that comes through in the book, because one thing that struck me is here's Alice, which is the Laura Bush character in the book, and she is from a pretty proper household, but you can see in her the changing ideas about women and sex as she makes her way through high school, and then, you know, we don't see her in college in the book, but after college, and I don't know. I you could almost call it an American life.
Well, yeah, I do think that, you know, Alice, the sort of norms or the expectations for women change so much during Alice's lifetime. So she's in high school, and it's very normal for a woman to either not go to college or drop out of college because she's getting married. But then because Alice gets married late, you know, late being the age of 31, she ends up working, she has a job, she lives on her own, and she's actually considering buying a house on her own, which is something that her own mother would never have done. And then meanwhile, the book follows her daughter, you know, into the year 2007, where her daughter is this, you know, working in finance in New York, and, you know, it would never occur to her daughter not to hold a job.
Tell me about the criticism that the book has gotten. How much of it has been from people who haven't read the book?
Well, I think that a couple months before publication, there were some, you know, online leaks that maybe misrepresented the book, and I think that got people a bit churned up. But in all honesty, I think that some of the people who might be, I don't know, concerned about the book have been so consumed by Sarah Palin that there's no room to think of anything else, including novels, which is okay. I mean, I don't feel like the book has actually stirred up that much controversy since its publication.
Because it's been overshadowed by real-life events.
Yeah, which I mean, I don't blame people. Like, obviously, I'm not a Palin supporter, but, you know, she's fascinating as a kind of character study.
Maybe she's your next novel?
I don't think so.
You know, I have read quite a few novels based on real people, but they've all been dead, other than David Levitt's While England Sleeps, which was based on Steven Spender's life, and then Levitt got sued and he had to rewrite the book.
I mean, I do think that, you know, I recognize that what I did is sort of a little bit peculiar. I don't think it's unprecedented, but I do feel like the one thing that made me able to justify it to myself, and of course, you know, everyone would view this differently, but is that I do have sincere affection and admiration for Laura Bush, and so I didn't feel like this book was coming from a place of, you know, mockery. It was more coming from this wish to sincerely understand what another person's life could be like. And I don't think that's exploitive or, you know, I don't think that's cruel. But, again, I'm sure that there are people who would not write this book or even would think, you know, nobody should write it.
Well, you know, talking about writing, I want to look back on prep and tell you that this book is much more mature. The writing style is much more mature. And do you feel that in yourself?
Well, I mean, honestly, as a writer, I think of, in a lot of ways, what I think of is structure and, you know, sort of boring technical things that non-writers don't really pay attention to, but writers are obsessed with. And so I think structurally, I'm not sure that it's that much different or you know, more complicated. But I think some of the kind of emotional themes that it addresses are probably more ambitious, where, you know, a lot of prep was about girlish angst. And I hope that I wrote about girlish angst intelligently, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's still girlish angst.
Well, I think that's a good point. It may be the nature of the characters, because the portraits in American Wife just seem to be fuller, closer to real people.
Yeah, I think I can see that. I can definitely see that.
So what are you working on?
Not a whole lot. I mean, I'm in this sort of promotional phase, or, you know, traveling to read from the book, and I have ideas for more novels, and there's one specific idea that I'm too superstitious to talk about, but I'm very excited about it, but I have not actually, you know, set any words down on the page.
So will you be touring all through the election season?
No, I'm actually going on a somewhat limited tour. I think I'm going to 8 cities total, and part of that is just sort of my personality, where I think there are people who are able to go to 40 places and still be really energetic, and I am not one of those people. You know, I think a lot of the reason I became a writer is so that I could sit at home by myself.
Do you think, I know you've been asked this before, but do you think that Mrs. Bush will read the book?
My guess is no, just because, you know, she's busy. She may have read things or heard things about the book that make it sound not entirely tempting to read. But a lot of people have said to me, of course she's going to. How can she not? And I don't know. I mean, if she ever does, even if it's now or if it's years from now, of course I would love to know what she thinks. But I'm not holding my breath.
Well, Curtis, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Robin Fisher talking with Curtis Sittenfeld about her latest novel, American Wife, which is loosely based on the life of Laura Bush. Sittenfeld will be signing copies of her book at Carmichael's Bookstore on Frankfort Avenue Thursday evening at 6:30. Vova Galchenko is a juggler in the classical sense. This means no knives, chainsaws, or flaming bowling pins. His talent with the traditional tools of jugglers has earned him a spot among the world's best. Originally from Russia, Galchenko now lives in the United States and was featured at this week's Idea Festival in Louisville. Gabe Bullard caught up with Galchenko to find out about the art of juggling.
And you're considered to be one of the best jugglers in the world?
So they say.
And so how did you end up at Idea Festival?
Well, what happened was I did a bunch of TV shows over the summer. I did I also did a feature with the New York Times, and then I did Nightline ABC. And I think they saw me in the New York Times article, and they thought I might be an interesting speaker, and so they invited me over. I'm actually pretty honored to be here. It's pretty cool to be here.
Do you talk about philosophy in your speech, like the philosophy of juggling, or how do you equate it beyond juggling?
Yeah, somewhat. I talk a lot about my views on juggling and about just hardcore jugglers' views on juggling in general, because a lot of people have a pretty skewed perception of what juggling is, of what jugglers do. You know, people think, you know, juggler is some sort of a clown guy who shows up and, you know, throws stuff in the air and juggles knives and fire and stuff like that. And so I talk a lot about the myths of that, because actually jugglers, you know, jugglers who are serious about juggling, you know, don't do any of the stuff that most people think jugglers do. So I'll talk quite a bit about that.
So what kind of stuff do you do?
I juggle bowls, clubs, and rings, which are the three main props, you know, that accepted in the juggling competitions. Clubs are, a lot of people refer to them as pins, which is wrong. They're clubs. But the clubs are the hardest to juggle out of the three, because you have to worry about the spin and such. The rings are hoop-like things, pretty self-explanatory, and so are balls, I guess. So those are the three things that I juggle.
Do you find that it's a pretty mental process in knowing where all the items you're juggling are at all times?
It's a mix of mental and physical, I guess. You think a lot about, you know, where the balls are supposed to go and how they're supposed to get there. And so, yeah, a lot of it is, you know, mental concentration and practice. A lot of it also is muscle memory. It's in that way, in that respect, it's similar to playing an instrument where, you know, you learn to do it and your muscles kind of remember that.
How has your ability to juggle affected your life outside of juggling?
Oh, it's affected it tremendously. I mean, if it weren't for juggling, I'd be in Russia right now. Most of my life I spent there, and that's where I was born. And because of juggling, I've been able to come out here and live here. And pretty much everything in my life could, in some way, be linked to juggling. So I guess it's affected my life quite a bit.
But like in your day-to-day life, like you wake up in the morning, you get some coffee, you read the paper.
Oh yeah, I practice 2 to 3 hours a day, so that's, you know, that's pretty substantial right there. I also, you know, do a lot to stay in shape, you know, work out and things like that.
Does the ability to juggle come in handy when you're doing other things?
Not to speak of. I guess it's sort of useless in that way.
So I imagine a lot of non-jugglers will be coming to see your speech.
Sure.
What could they take away from this?
I talk a lot about talent, and a lot of people seem to have this this perception that if you're not talented, you're not going to be, you know, any good at juggling, and, you know, all this hand-eye coordination and etc. And that's actually pretty far from truth. I found that, you know, I've taught people how to juggle, and I've taught myself how to juggle, and so the biggest component of it is, you know, just practice. And it's a lot simpler than you would think. There's none of this mystical talent stuff going on. So I think it'll be sort of inspirational in that respect.
So you're saying somebody isn't necessarily born with
exactly
a certain talent. They can always learn
exactly
it.
It's more nurture than nature.
That was Gabe Bullard talking with juggler Vova Galchenko, who was in town for the Idea Festival. You You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.